thanks everybody. I guess, you know, this way you can just see that there is a broad, you know, and a diverse coalition of members of Congress on, you know, in the House and the Senate who care about these issues. I guess the hard part is just that there are so many issues to focus on. But I think probably, you know, now following up on what Karen, you know, asked, you know, turning things over to questions, you know, maybe start off with like Karen's first question. I think it's a very important question, trying to really talk about, you know, sort of how do we think about who are the women that we're, you know, and the families that we're trying to help here? You know, should we be focusing only on low income, middle class? How, you know, is it everyone? How do we talk about that and think about it? And so maybe Dr. Appleman, starting off with you.
Well, you know, with as Heidi pointed out, some 50% of workers don't have even any paid sick days. So this is, in my view, much more than a problem that only affects the working poor. Clearly, they lack many things, and for them, everything's a crisis. You know, a sick child, a car that breaks down, because there's no flexibility in their budget. But when we're talking about being able to take time off because you have a sick child, when we're talking about paid family and medical leave, these are issues that affect really a large swath of the population. You have to get into the professional or managerial classes before you really have people who, if they need to take paid family leave, essentially can use their paid vacation days. And of course, there's a large group of people for whom that is true. They're not really our target. They can afford good quality childcare. They can self-finance their paid family leave. They probably need paid medical, although they might have short-term disability where they work. But it rises fairly high into the middle class, the people that we're talking about who need these protections and who would benefit. And if I could just say one word, the other question was on the table from the audience was Holly's question about do we need an omnibus bill? At the state level and our various coalitions, the reason that we're pushing for an omnibus bill is that without that, you end up dividing allies. So in New Jersey, for example, before we began speaking of this more broadly, when I spoke with the state Fed from the AFL-CIO and said paid family leave is really important in New Jersey, they said, well, yes, it is, but you know, universal health care is our highest priority. By having an omnibus bill, which may perhaps have to be, you know, shaped in some way, pruned in some way, but something that takes the really high priority items like living wage, like universal health care, like quality child care, and like paid sick days, paid family leave, and puts them together, gives us a much stronger coalition. Otherwise, it's not that people will oppose it, but they sit on their hands. You need something out there that everybody says, my top issue is in there. That's my view of it.
Do you want to comment on Karen?
Yeah, I would say that, Karen, that both are possible. That is, that both speaking about them as the middle class, the need for the middle class, and a need for the working poor, you know, should be done. I think people are more open to talking about the working poor. Lots of candidates are emphasizing inequality and the failure of the minimum wage to grow, the failure of living wages to, you know, be prevalent. So I think there is more, you know, just openness in society for understanding the problems of the working poor. And, you know, everybody, I think, cares about the quality of, you know, child care, children. And, however, I have heard, I believe it was from people in Washington State, that the way to really get your state legislature on these bills is to talk about the sick grandma. Are you telling me that I can't stay home to take care of my sick grandma? And you have a grandma, don't you? And that one is even perhaps more powerful, but I think seriously that people are very open to these issues now. Just looking at the data that I showed you before in figure four, even for the top two quartiles, the majority of workers cannot use their paid sick days for doctor visits or sick children. So it's both a middle class and a working class issue.
I'm so glad you asked that question.
You have feelings. Maybe I do.
I actually think it's exactly the right question we need to be asking each other and we need to be talking about at length, because I think we've got a little ways to go to figure out how to get to talk about this in the public that resonates, and I think part of it is talking about it in a way that's a little bit more comprehensively engaging, and I think some of that is not just focusing on one or the other, but you know, lower class or middle class or upper class, because everyone's got work and family struggles. And I think people would say that. And I think they may look a little bit different. And I think in some ways, I think this is my bias of working on with low-income moms in Montana for 11 years and, you know, getting them to vote and getting them civically engaged around creating policies that they wanted to see happen, that we need to look at women's work experience on a spectrum. And I think we need to talk about it as a workforce development issue. And if you look at even just minimum wage, the next breath out of our mouths, you know, is yes, we need an increase in minimum wage, and we need to talk about the quality of jobs that women need to stay in the workforce, be productive, and, you know, achieve this maybe untenable work-life balance issue. But what can we do? But I think not in a way that eliminates talking about, you know, the rest of the families that are also struggling with different, maybe different complications, or just a one step beyond the complication that low-income women are facing. But I think we owe it to the people that we're working on behalf of to talk about this in a more comprehensive way that does really acknowledge women's work life on a spectrum and sort of allows room for growth and movement and sustainability. And I think we're almost there, but not quite. And I think some of it does have to do with really being deliberate about who we're talking about. The last thing I'll say is, and from looking at what happened in Madison, we had that city, the first citywide ordinance, and it lost by one vote. And, you know, one of the things we learned from talking to the folks that were on the ground there was that people really did resonate when stories were told. The human face on the issue went a long way to getting some of those no votes to yes votes on the ordinance, and that there was needed, there's a clear sense that there's more of that was needed. And I think San Francisco, with their ballot initiative organizing, is really on top of that. And, you know, I think they're poised to win. If we've seen anything that's got momentum to win on paid sick days in the country, it's this. And, you know, I think that should speak volumes. Really.
Well, actually, yeah, I'd like to turn it over to everybody. Everybody else who hasn't had a chance to speak yet, so please feel free to ask a question.
Hi, I'm Michelle Friedman with the Coalition of Human Needs. First, thanks to the organizations at the table, as well as the staff and members who have been working on these issues so hard for so long. I have partnered with some of the organizations in trying to get co-sponsors for the 7 days of paid sick leave. And one of the very first questions is about the cost-benefit analysis. So it's great that IWPR has done that. I want to ask a question. A big hunk of the savings seems to come from retention, lack of turnover. And I wonder, because I can visualize some of these same staffers wanting to unpack that a little bit, because we know there are a lot of issues, of course, for turnover. So I'm just wondering what some of the assumptions are, because the reduction in turnover is a huge percentage of the savings. And what were the assumptions in coming up with that savings based on reduced turnover?
Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. We had to use a lot of other people's research to come up with these estimates, and what we used there was a study specifically looking at voluntary turnover. One researcher had estimated that turnover falls by a very small amount, like 5% less turnover for workers who have paid sick leave compared to workers who don't. So even such a small decline in turnover has big cost savings. For the cost of what it costs to replace a worker, we used the Employment Policies Foundation. This is a conservative foundation that we don't often cite, but it is supported by the National Restaurant Association, among other groups. Employers support this group, and they said 25% of annual earnings is a typical cost of any turnover. So basically, I think using quite conservative estimates on how much turnover would be reduced, we came up with the $26 billion or so in savings there. And it doesn't even count the involuntary turnover. You know, if you have to quit your job, well, you don't exactly quit, you're fired. You know, a lot of jobs, you don't show up. It doesn't matter that you're sick. You don't show up, you're out. So we don't even measure that at all. I mean, basically, that's an irrational thing for an employer to do, to fire someone for being sick. Even low-wage sales, you know, a typical Walmart, I think, is probably a pretty good indicator of a low-wage sales job. If in the time that a new retail worker is learning that job, she or he loses customers and often mistakenly, you know, mistakenly identifies which product the person wants, and it can lead also to undercharging for products and services. So that's, you know, even in an area where, you know, turnover doesn't matter. I mean, a lot of employers seem to think it doesn't matter, but these are the kinds of cost savings that they would experience if they enjoyed this lower turnover. So we have a full report on the website. I will tell you the number. It's up there, and it's, is it 252 or something like that? Where's my publications person? I'll tell it to you in a moment. But on our website, you can look under Work and Family. You can look under PDFs, under publications, and you will find this one, B, as in boy, 248. And it's called Valuing Good Health, an Estimate of the Cost and Savings for the Healthy Families Act, and it's 21 pages.
Other questions?
One of the things that we do, at least in New Jersey, is we have to distinguish between paid sick days and paid medical leave. And we try not to use the word leave when we're using the word sick days. We're talking about the Health and Families Act because people find it confusing. Paid sick days is something that employers should be providing to all of their workers. A minimum of 7 such days is as high as when you're out well within the affordability and on the cost-benefit basis, a win for employers. When you talk about paid family medical leave, this is something that, in fact, is rarely used by workers. These serious illnesses where you need to be out for a long time, a heart attack, a stroke, some very serious illness that you have or that a family member has, or the birth of a new child or a new child coming into the family, adopted or foster child. These are rare events in anybody's life. As a percentage of the workforce, it's a very small percentage, but these are critical events when they occur. And it's really important that people have access to income during those periods of time. And while these are rare events spread over the workforce, if you happen to be a hospital that employs a lot of young women as nurses or nursing assistants, it's not so rare for you. And so to require employers to pay this really puts employers at a disadvantage based on who their workforce is and so on, and provides incentives that we don't like for not hiring women. We still have the bulk of the care responsibilities. And we're the only ones who give birth. So based on those two things, we would like this to be social insurance. It's very affordable, spread out over everybody. It would be very expensive for some employers to try to provide on their own. So that's the first thing. And then in terms of how to structure it, we've learned a lot from all the battles that we've lost and from the one that we won in California. The first point is the old idea was to make it part of unemployment insurance. We already have a social insurance scheme. Why not make it part of UI? And this turns out to be bad for at least two reasons. The first is it drives a wedge between unions and those who advocate for families, because unions feel very strongly that UI needs to be there. If there's a recession, we're all going to need to collect our unemployment insurance, and they're reluctant to see it used for anything else. And employers object to it even more strenuously than they ordinarily object to things, because UI is experience rated. And so you have a lot of women taking leave, and how are you going to handle that? And it has nothing to do with the workplace or the employer. So it just creates unnecessary, excessive opposition. The next thing that we learned is that there's no reason to go to the mat over what appears to be a fairness issue. Shouldn't this cost be shared equally among employers and employees? I am an economist, it's too long a story now, but I'm happy to give this little lecture whenever people ask. Economists will tell you it does not matter who you write into the law that will pay for it. Supply and demand will determine who actually pays for it. You can easily see this. If you work for IBM in Austin, Texas, where there's very low payroll taxes and they want to move you to the Silicon Valley facility where the payroll taxes are very high, what do they do? Well, they raise your pay. If you get an executive to make that move, the company raises your pay to cover the higher taxes in California. So even though you're paying it out of your pay, because that's what the law requires, your employer has paid it because they gave you money to do it. So there's no point in going to the mat over how the law is written. And there are many, many advantages we have learned by having workers pay the whole thing themselves. First of all, we get to determine who is eligible. You want domestic partners? Fine. You don't have to fight with employers over it. They're not paying? You don't ask them their opinion. No carve-out for small employers. Why should there be a carve-out for small employers? No employer is paying into this fund. So why do we need to carve-out for small employers? You can make it up to 12 weeks if you want. They settled for 6 weeks in California because they hadn't figured this whole thing out yet, but in New Jersey, we're asking for 12 weeks. We're paying for it. We're willing to pay for it. Give us the 12 weeks. And the latest calculation is that it's 26 cents a week. Our minimum wage is 7.15 an hour. So for a minimum wage worker, it's 26 cents a week. For the premium, we don't talk about it as taxes. These are insurance premiums for which you get an insurance benefit. And for the average worker, it's less than a dollar. And if you're making $94,000 a year or more, it's under $2 a week for you. So, you know, people want it. And also, if we're in charge, we make the wage base the Social Security wage base and not the unemployment insurance wage base. In D.C., the uninsurance fund wage base is less than $10,000. So low-wage workers pay it on 100% of their income, and the rest of us pay it only on the first $10,000 in D.C. In my state of New Jersey, it's $25,000. But because employers have to pay it, they fight really hard to keep the wage base low. The way we get this really low premium for all the workers is we make the wage base the Social Security wage base. There's no additional work. Everybody has to do the payroll, has to take out the Social Security. Make it the first $94,000 that everybody earns. It's fair. It's low. These are the reasons that we want it. And then there are safeguards for employers, even if I would like not to have these safeguards, but this is how we get to the win-win. The first is that in California and also in our New Jersey proposals, the first week is unpaid. You have to realize that most family leaves. Medical is your own sickness. You have a heart attack. You're out till you're better. But if you are taking off time because your mother or father had a heart attack, you need a week or two to get them settled. So 80% of family leaves, other than bonding with a new child, are over in 10 days or less. So if the first week is unpaid, you're not talking about a huge incentive for people to go out and cheat on this. It's only partial wage replacement. It's not full wage replacement. In California, it's 55% of wages, but then up to over $800 a week. In New Jersey, it would be two-thirds of wages. But we have a lower count. And there are no new job protections. This is the other thing. I'm a small business, and if somebody has a sick parent has to take off, I can't get the work done, I'm going to have to. You know what? If you have an employee whose child has leukemia and says, listen, I have to take time off, and you say, you know what? You're fired. If a kid with leukemia, you're fired. You can still do it. But what is the reason that employee should not be able to collect partial wage replacement from an insurance fund for 12 weeks while they're getting themselves back on their feet? It didn't come out of your pocket. It doesn't cost you anything. You can still fire them, and they can still collect partial wage replacement. And basically, I've been on panels with employers, and they are out of things to say at the end of that.
Can you tell us where do things stand in New Jersey? How far along? I mean, there's legislation pending, and
these things are like so. I hate to discuss them publicly. Yeah, we worked so hard to elect Governor Corzine because he was in favor of all these things when he was in the Senate. But if he would say one word, we would be in good shape. We have a bill that has been written. We have a powerful, powerful state senator who, with one word from the governor, would introduce this, and it would then pass overwhelmingly. But we don't have that one word. So our coalition is very well organized, and we're still hoping that senator will drop this bill soon. If not, we have other less powerful women, shall I say, as opposed to this powerful man. Anyway, we certainly have women in both houses of our state legislature ready to introduce this whenever we say that's what we really need, and then we'll be into struggle mode. But the legislation has been written, we've costed it out, we know what it will be. I would say one last thing about the slow cost. There are five states which have temporary disability insurance, and they are California, New Jersey, New York, Hawaii, and Rhode Island. In those states, the add-on for family leave is very, very, very low. In the states that do not already have it, they will have a hard time starting with 12 weeks because you've got to build up the system for it. It will not be as cheap in a Washington state as it is in California.
Actually, my recollection was that there was recently a study of the California paid leave system, which basically found usage was lower than expected and the costs were lower than expected.
That is correct. We all anticipated, and at first in New Jersey too, we budgeted for 3% because we know the 3% report, 3% of workers report that they've taken a family leave. But only 1.5% claims the insurance, and I think there are three reasons for that. The first is, if you're a professional, these leaves are over mostly, 80% of them are over in 10 days or less. So if you have paid vacation, you can get 100% wage replacement. You just like, so if you're a professional or a manager and you have to take a family leave, you don't call it a family leave. You just say, well, I want to use some of my vacation leave right now. And so we think that they're not taking it. The second thing is the first week is unpaid. If the leave is over in 7 or 8 days and it's just partial wage replacement, it might not be worth it. So you have to do paperwork and apply to the state for this. It's not something you just go into the HR office. So it might not be worth it to you to do the paperwork to apply to the state to get that replacement. We're talking about very little money. And the third is we're working really, really hard to get the word out to main people that we hope to have it help. And we don't know how many of them do know about it and are actually using it, but we hope to get those numbers up somewhat. It will still be incredibly cheap. I mean, we budgeted for a much larger number of people taking it. They're running surpluses now in California, even at this low premium rate.
I think even in Massachusetts, though, which is establishing this strong family fund in lieu of something that's already existing like TDI, it's still only $2.50 a week for higher earners and $1 a week for minimum wage earners. And it's a 12 weeks paid, $7.50 a week maximum. So I think it can be done.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just wanted to say the low New Jersey numbers might not work in your state, but sure, it's not high. I can just tell you, TDI puts me, I'm at the top of the income scale for this, puts me $240 a year.
Wow.
The TDI, the medical leave part of it. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking huge numbers, you're right.
Did you want to say something?
No, I have a question. Okay.
Oh,
I wanted to move on a little bit. Given the experiences that you guys have had in New Jersey and at the national level, I mean, A, these things are cheap. They pull well, right? So we can do them. People want them. There's a lot of activism and energy going on in terms of people are trying to push them. Two questions just always emerge in my mind, like, why aren't we moving faster, and why do these remain partisan issues? I mean, it's between both Republican and Democratic families to have kids and have to struggle with these work and family issues. Would somebody like to
did everybody hear the question? I guess I've been asked, just so everyone knows, I guess the question is, why haven't we passed all of these things, and why does there seem to be still be some partisanship to these issues? And so whoever wants to jump on that.
I mean, the main opposition comes from the business lobby. It's not really coming from business. I go wherever I'm invited to any business group to speak about this, and generally speaking, if I can, they give me the 10 minutes to explain the whole thing. They can see that this is an advantage to them. It's an advantage to small business. In a state like New Jersey, where we have a lot of the best companies for women to work for, it's really hard for small businesses to recruit top women because we have J&J and Colgate and Deloitte and Touche and Wachovia. That's where the women will go. But if you can say, well, you know, we have in the state, I may not be able as a small employer to afford these benefits, but you have them because we're in New Jersey. This is a big help. So the businesses themselves can see it, but the business lobbyists are opposed to anything. They simply want no mandates is one thing, and just to be a little blunt about it, they use the fact that we want to push for something like paid family leave as it's a fundraiser for them. Send us money, we're going to defeat this mandate. You don't want a mandate. So it's as simple as that, in my opinion. There's strong opposition from the business lobby.
Well, can I just quickly say that when we were working on the Family Medical Leave Act, you know, one part of our strategy was reaching out to the progressive employers, you know, and the, you know, there are a coalition of them, reaching out to the employers who are already doing, you know, these kinds of things in the workplace, providing good sick leave, providing, you know, parental leave. Also, reaching out to, like, the women business owners. I mean, there was, you know, an active strategy, and it wasn't, and so that actually created a bit of leverage so that you know, it wasn't just the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, you know, et cetera. It wasn't everybody against us, that, you know, we did have some coalitions of, you know, they were smaller coalitions, but we, you know, leveraged them for as much as we could get to, you know, make it seem like it was at least a debate on the employer side.
Right.
And, you know, but it was hard work. I mean, you know, not to underestimate it, and you really had to cultivate, I mean, because the business folks are, even the employers who are doing great things, the employers who, you know, like to consider themselves progressive on these kinds of issues, they are very reluctant to either criticize their, you know, their colleagues, their, you know, or to be perceived as somehow breaking ranks. But, you know, we were able to do it. And so I guess, hopefully you can...
All the state groups, I think, are working on that, but I thought it's very important. Yeah.
Sorry, I guess I
didn't.
Okay.
Just a second, what Michelle said, that's one of the strengths that we were looking at is how to reach out to those businesses again and take things one step further. You know, we have FMLA that's been able to help 50 million Americans since it was passed, but we need to go further and take leave and offer some of the other things that I've been looking at. So that's really the piece that needs to happen. In thinking about the answer to the question of, you know, why is this taking so long, I think definitely the opposition of businesses is there. And one thing that we've come across when we talk about pay sick days is, well, we can't do this. We can't even handle our health care costs from the end of small businesses or businesses. I think if we found a comprehensive solution to health care, then perhaps they would be in a better position to what they perceive as other mandates.
Right, well, luckily we're not talking about healthcare today. That will be a whole other series that will, okay, at least a 10-parter, and certainly the long saga. So anyhow, at this point, I mean, unless there are other questions, just want to, I think on behalf of all the congressional staff, want to thank the Center for Economic and Policy Research for organizing this whole series. It's really been, I think, very inspiring for all of us. And, you know, and I think it's, you know, just motivating for all of us to be with other people who are thinking about these issues, care about these issues. I know Heather wanted to say a few last words,
thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you to just a fabulous, fabulous panel. I knew it would be brilliant. And thank you all for coming. A couple of things. One, as I said at the end of every briefing, audio files and photos and all of the handouts and presentations from the whole series is available on our webpage, as well as pictures from today's events and last time's event. So if you want to check that out, it's at www.cfer.net. And again, thank you to all of the offices and, of course, to the Casey Foundation for funding this, and to all of you for coming. So thank you.
All right, to be continued after the election.
Yeah.
Okay, now everyone, you know, go out and do your